The next CMO podcast explores topics that are on the minds of forward-thinking marketing executives, from leadership and strategy to emerging technologies. And we bring these topics to life by interviewing leading experts in their fields. The next CMO is sponsored by Plana, makers of the world's first AI-based marketing leadership platform, and hosted by me, Peter Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Plana, along with my co-host, Kelsey Kraft. In this episode of The Next CMO, I speak to Brian Clayton, a serial entrepreneur in the home services and lawn care market. Brian has had a fascinating entrepreneurial journey, starting from the day his dad told him to stop playing video games and go out and mow the lawn, to growing a business of 150 people with $10 million of annual revenue, and ultimately selling that business to the largest landscaping company in the U.S. But that was just Brian's first act. In his second act, he's built GreenPal, the Uber for lawn care, which now serves 200,000 households and generates over $20 million in annual revenue. I learned a ton from my conversation with Brian, a natural marketer, and I'm sure you will too. Hey, welcome, and we're thrilled to have with us today on the Next CMO podcast, Brian Clayton, who's the CEO and founder of GreenPal, which has been called the Uber for lawn care by Entrepreneur Magazine. So Brian, welcome aboard.
Peter, thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
I've been really looking forward to this discussion, Brian, because you have a really amazing story building a great business. And I think our listeners are really going to gain a lot from your experience building something up from something that was probably pretty small to something that's sounds like it's been quite successful. Give us a little bit of the story. How did this all start, Brian?
Yeah, so been at GreenPal for 8 years. We're an 8-year overnight success. We started off in the summer of 2013, getting this app going, building out this marketplace. And we ended the first year with something like $5,000 in total revenue. And so it was a really slow start. It was very humble beginnings, but we just kept at it little by little, growing it, making the platform better, making the app better. And now today we have over 200,000 homeowners using the app to get the lawn mowed, doing around $20 million a year in revenue and growing. And before GreenPal, I actually had a landscaping company that I started in high school as a way to make extra cash. Luckily, my dad forced me to go mow the neighbor's yard on a hot summer day. One day, he interrupted me playing Nintendo, and he said, "Hey, listen, bud, you got a job to do. You're going to go cut the neighbor's grass." And I'm glad he did, because something about that just stuck with me. I made 20 bucks, and I just never looked back. I remember the first thing I did is I was passing out flyers trying to get some more people to mow yards for, and I just stuck with that little lawn mowing business all through high school, all through college. And over a 15-year period of time, I was able to build it into one of the largest landscaping companies in the state of Tennessee, getting it over 150 employees, over $10 million in revenue. And then in 2013, the business was acquired by one of the largest landscaping companies in the United States. And growing that first business, just me and a push mower to me and 150 people, I learned a lot the hard way just on how to build a business from scratch, how to market a business. And I rolled all of that into my second company, GreenPal, all of the domain knowledge, all of the industry knowledge. And so that's 20 years of entrepreneurship in one industry.
It's an amazing story, and I love how you called it an 8-year overnight success, because that kind of patience and stick-to-itiveness is one of the things that I think really differentiates entrepreneurs, because you saw this thing from the early stage, you got some of the early signals, and obviously it just takes staying with it for a long time to make it work. Let's start with this first business. That's amazing, going from literally pushing a lawnmower yourself to 150 employees. Now, very different business in the services business. So you went from a pure services business to more of a marketplace business. And does the new business offer, do you have staff that does the work, or are you truly a marketplace?
Yeah, you make a very good point. The first company was, I was building the best, biggest landscaping company in my market. And so that was, I had employees, trucks, equipment. It was very hand-to-hand combat, very asset intense. It was very traditional blue collar style of business that I built up over time. And then when I sold that company, I had to restart again and figure out how to reinvent myself almost as an entrepreneur and learn how to build software and learn how to build a marketplace that connects buyers and sellers. So my current business, GreenPal, we don't own any lawnmowers. We don't own any trucks. We don't have any lawn equipment, but we do three times the business that my first company did. It's the new way of the way the world's going. Like Uber doesn't own any cars. Amazon doesn't own any stores. Facebook doesn't create any content. And so a lot of these platforms that have emerged to match supply and demand have come about in the last decade. And we're certainly part of that trend. Although very humbly started out, it was just a handful of transactions. Now it's hundreds of thousands, but we just always focused on creating a product that made it just simpler and easier for users on both sides of the transaction to conduct business. And we still to this day focus on that. That's all we care about is how do we make it faster, cheaper, smoother, easier for both parties to conduct business on our app rather than doing it the old way.
So is there a key thing that you saw, Brian, when you were starting out in the business that you identified that said that, hey, here's a missing thing? So what drove you to this idea of a marketplace versus trying to create the same kind of business with labor and trucks and equipment and things that you had in the past?
Yeah, it was a couple of things. One was when I built that company and sold it, I wanted something new. So I wanted a new challenge. And I thought, wow, that was really hard. That took 15 years. It was really difficult running that company. It was very challenging. And I thought, now I want to do something easy. Now I want to do a software-enabled business because that'll be easier. I literally, that's what I thought. And man, I did not know what I didn't know. Running a software company and building a marketplace is an order of magnitude more challenging than a traditional style of business. And on top of all that, you're inventing a brand new product from scratch that does not yet exist. And so the dynamics of that make it really challenging. And so I was confronted with that reality really quick when my two co-founders and I started GreenPal, when we started really understanding how difficult this was going to be. But I always knew that it was going to work. I knew it was a good idea. I knew it had to work, because I just saw the problems and inefficiencies for 15 years in the industry, running a business in the industry. I just saw firsthand how difficult it was for homeowners to get hooked up with your smaller solopreneurs, your smaller service providers, because they didn't have any real kind of visibility and it was hard to get a hold of them. And I knew that an app needed to exist to connect these buyers and sellers. And then on top of that, I saw what Uber and Lyft were doing and Airbnb, making these real world experiences happen magically almost. And I thought, okay, this is going to work. So at least I knew it was a good idea. But what I didn't know was how challenging it was going to be to A, learn how to build software, and then B, it's really difficult inventing something from scratch that does not yet exist. And I under-indexed on that. And then on top of that, building a marketplace is really challenging because you're constantly trying to strike that delicate balance between buyers and sellers and orchestrate a solution to both parties' needs that makes sense and delivers value to both sides. And that took a long time. It took a long time of trial and error to figure it out.
There's so much in there, Brian. This is great. So let me start with the marketplace model, because you're right. That is a really tricky one, because obviously you need critical mass on both sides to get started. You need enough suppliers and you need enough customers so that you can actually make something happen. And so did you start out in limited markets and fan out from there? So how did you get the thing jump started?
Yeah, you nailed it. Really good point. The canonical chicken and egg problem for every marketplace, it exists. It's very real. It's hard to overcome. And for us, we learned very early on that one of the only assets we had at our disposal was just focus, was just trying to distill this down to as small a thing as we could and focus on throwing all of our effort into it to make it work on a small scale. And so we're from Nashville, Tennessee, and so we were just in Nashville for 3 or 4 years with this app, trying to make it work. And not even just Nashville, really just one part of Nashville. We focused on a part of town that our value proposition resonated better with them. And we knew if we could make it work there, then we could make it work in all of Nashville. And then we knew we could make it work in Atlanta. And then we knew we could make it work in Tampa. And so starting really slow and low and just focusing on just the fewest number of inputs, and that's what enabled us to get that supply and demand on the platform at the same time and spark those interactions between the two and get critical mass, and then, and not necessarily just get critical mass, but figure out how to do it and develop the playbook to replicate it out through every town and city in the United States. But today we're nationwide. We're in every city in the country, and soon to be in Canada and UK. But it started off this really humbly, really simply, and then we knew we could just like almost like concentric circles expand out further and further after we nailed the little playbook.
So what was the core problem that you were trying to solve that was unsolved with traditional service providers in the lawn care space?
Yeah, so we had that. When you're starting something from scratch, you have all these assumptions that you think are true. And as you are building the product, you need to validate those assumptions. Are they true or are they not? And for us, I was coming to the equation with 15 years of experience in the industry, but that was as a contractor. So I saw the problem from one standpoint. And what I believed to be true in the early days was we had to innovate on price, and we had to figure out a way to make lawn mowing services cheaper, because I was coming to the equation from a contractor's perspective. And when you're a contractor, you get a little jaded. You think all people care about is price. They will hire somebody else for $5 cheaper, and you could get like that beat into your head. And so when we launched the first version of the product, we met with as many users of the product as we could. And back in those days, it was less than 100, but we would meet with everybody that would meet with us, because we knew that we needed that feedback to figure out, to A, validate if this was worth spending a decade on, and B, validate if we were building something that people would pay for to use, and if we were solving the right problems. And in those interviews with people, we began to hear like the same things over and over again. Their lawn guy or lawn gal flaked on them, ghosted them, disappeared. The lawn was 4 feet tall. They needed somebody today, and they needed somebody just to show up on a consistent basis. And that's all they needed. We never heard price. We never heard, oh, I have a lawn service that's doing it for $32 a mowing, but I was wanting to see if you guys could find me somebody to do it for $24. We never heard that. And the only thing we heard was, I needed somebody reliable, and I need somebody today. And so it was through those interactions and those interviews with users, we began to understand we're really not competing on price. Price is important. It needs to be market. But really what we're innovating on and delivering is reliability and speed. And that really was a game changer for us, because we were able to modify how we communicated our value proposition, modify the copy, modify how we built the product, what we really focused our attention on in terms of features and what we optimized for. And had we not done that, had we just continued on my set of assumptions, we may not have built something that people would continue to use. Because a lot of times if you're optimizing for cheap, then it's not going to be reliable. And so they were delivering the opposite of what they wanted. That was an early thing that we learned, and we wouldn't have learned it had we not met with everybody that would meet with us.
Well, there's a great lesson for marketers in there, by the way, Brian. And the lesson is that you need to test and validate your messages for your offer and continue to refine them over time. And you're right, you would have never been so successful. It's mind-blowing that you have 200,000 homeowners. You could have never done that with a physical business, obviously. And reaching that scale is amazing. And I can certainly see that the convenience, the reliability of the service would be really important. The other thing that must be really interesting, I'd suspect, is that, and you may have a perspective coming from this, obviously, as someone who spent years being a service provider, I think it's hard for service providers to market themselves and drum up business. And there's a huge value proposition for those service providers if literally they can tap in to a network of demand. And so how is that demand created? Do you play the role in creating overall demand for the service?
Yeah, we learned really quick that the platform's success was going to be a function of how much demand we could generate for service providers. We learned really early we could hand crank the supply side. We could just cold call 100 of them and get 10 on the platform. Where the choke point was and where we were constrained was getting consumers onto the platform. And so we learned really early on that we were going to have to become like preeminent marketers of lawn care services in the world to make this thing work. Like that was table stakes. We had to figure out a way to get the product in people's hands in order to tee them up for lawn care services. And if we couldn't do that, then the whole thing would be a ghost town. And so as part of the core competency of the business, really early on, we began to really focus a lot of intensity on how do we market the platform. And we began to learn, we began to test in every single channel that we could. And at the time, I was reading a book called My Life in Scientific Advertising by a guy by the name of Claude Hopkins. And in that book, he says that we will let the hundreds decide what the thousands will do. And that really stuck with me. And I began to learn that, like, there really are no expert marketers. There's just expert testers.
A little note from the editor. Brian was talking about two different books from Claude Hopkins. One is called Scientific Advertising, published in 1923. And then he followed up in 1927 with a book called My Life in Advertising. And we'll put links to those in the show notes. Back to Brian.
And so we just really began early on testing as much as we could with what limited traffic we had to try to figure out what copy converted better, what framing of the value proposition converted better, what channels converted better. Would Facebook ads work? Would Instagram ads work? Would Twitter ads work? And we really started funneling down on the things that were working, and then we leaned into those and just doubled down on what was working. We didn't try to fix what wasn't working. We just did more of what was working. And what we found was, for us, dollar for dollar, organic search was the best thing that we could invest in. We learned that really early on that if we had an extra $1,000 to spend, we were better off doing it with organic search and creating a property that would rank well for the keywords we needed to rank for. And we have tried to beat that ever since. For 8 years, we've tried to figure out better ROI for dollars, but we still can't. And so from now, even still to this day, half of our users come through just simple organic search, and the other half come through word of mouth. And until we can't get a better ROI in another channel, we'll continue to keep doubling down on organic search.
Yeah, it's amazing. First of all, the approach you take is one that I really advocate in our book, in the Next CMO book, is the idea of being a scientist more than a marketer. And marketers sometimes feel like they have to sort of promote and spin their results into something that they're not quite. And if you use the scientific method, it's about having a thesis, designing some tests, running the tests, looking at the data, and then let the data tell you what to do. And, yeah. And in your case, it's organic search works really well. And it sounds like over the 8 year period, you're doing exactly what you should, which is you're continuing to run tests to see if you can beat it.
We want to unlock another channel, right? We really do. And so we're constantly experimenting in new platforms and new channels, but we let the data talk. And you hear the word marketer, and if you're not a marketer, then you might think of like a Mad Men style situation where you've got people just making like really smart decisions based off of experience and gut. And the reality is it's got to be data driven these days. Everything has to really lean. Yeah, there's a place for brand marketing with big budgets, but in most cases, it's going to be more performance. And even in that book, My Life in Scientific Advertising, one thing I found fascinating about the book was this dude wrote the book in the 40s. And even then, they were split testing different coupons that they ran in newspapers. And they split tested, they would run like one set of copy in one market newspaper and another set of copy in another market. And they would gauge the response. So even back then, 80 years ago, the marketers were the good ones, knew to be data driven. And so I think that's table stakes these days. I think any experienced marketer knows that. But my point is more along the lines of, the entrepreneur needs to know that too. If you want to start a startup and you want to invent a new product from scratch, you're going to have to think like a marketer. It's going to have to be one of the hats you wear, and you're going to have to let the data speak. And what I see a lot of is startup entrepreneurs and or just new business owners in general will come up with this like great business plan or build this thing, and then they try to sprinkle some marketing on top of it. And that's really not how it works. You have to have that growth and marketing baked in from the ground up. And luckily we were able to stumble upon like SEO as a channel for us. And that's baked into the DNA of the company, like how we compete in SEO and how we deliver the best content and how we surface insights from the things that the platform is doing. And the exhaust of the platform almost is fodder and content for an SEO strategy. Like that stuff's hard to sprinkle in at the end. And so that's just been my experience. Think about growth marketing along with everything else when you're starting the business.
So you have a bunch of interesting marketing challenges in your business. You've got the customer acquisition. You've got the notion of service provider acquisition, which is a marketing challenge, I assume, at some point in some way. You've got value realization from your customers and customer retention and expansion and selling more services. So there has to be also an element of wringing the most value out of your customers and, of course, delivering them great value. So how do you think about the separation of those three missions of acquiring a brand new customer, user of GreenPal, which we should all on this radio, on this broadcast, be users of. I've now discovered this is exciting. And then second, you've got a mission of acquiring the supply of service. And then third, you've got the mission of trying to drive as much customer value out of each individual customer user.
Yeah, and when you're bootstrapped and you're a solo entrepreneur, or maybe you just you and a co-founder and you have a small team, to your point, it's so easy to get flustered. What do I even focus on? And I think it's not static. I don't think you focus on one thing and that's it. I think it's dynamic in terms of you shift your focus up and down the stack as time goes on. So it's, you can't just say, oh, just worry about retention and nothing else. If you're building a marketplace like us, you have to get some kind of liquidity going. Like you have to get top of the funnel people to come in the front door. That is the most important thing. But then once you get to a milestone of maybe 1,000 users, then it would behoove you to move to the retention piece and figure out, okay, I gotta keep these people. Otherwise, and I gotta figure out why they're pissed off and not sticking around. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how many people I put at the top. So I think I was reading a book when we first got started called The Startup Owner's Manual, and the name of the author is Steve Blank. And in the book, he talks about this funnel, but it's two funnels on opposite ends and a pipe that connects them. And in the funnel, he talks about, you just got to focus on three things: get, keep, grow. So get, like when you first get started, you got to be working on the get piece. And then almost subsequently, you have to work on the keep piece in terms of figuring out what is it you have to do to retain these people. And then the grow piece is how do you leverage them to tell more people about it. And you're constantly like you're moving up and down that stack as time is going on. And as you're achieving some sort of traction, and you're always returning back to different pieces of it as the business is growing. Then ideally, you build out a team that can focus on these things all the time. So you have an acquisition team, you have a retention team, and you have a referral team. And these are smart folks that if it's a purely digital product, maybe you've got an engineer and a designer and a data analyst on each one of those teams. Like that's the dream. That's how like these multi-billion dollar companies are forged. But if you're a startup and you've only got three people in a garage, then you kind of have to focus and triage around what is the most important thing right now. And when you're first getting started, it's get. And then as time goes on, it's keep. And then maybe even go back to get some more. And then some keep and then some grow. That's been my experience bootstrapping this team from scratch. Now I've got 24 people that work in the business and a lot of smart people. And I've got a full-time head of growth. And alongside her is an engineer and is a data analyst and a designer. That's all they do, because it pulls in all these disciplines. But in the early days, it was very much, okay, what do we focus on? Let's just focus on this aspect of what we're doing and make it better, and then we can move on to the other thing.
So as I think about your business, Brian, I think that I'm really excited about it, just talking about it, because you can see the really interesting, once you've got this 200,000 mind-blowing number of homeowners that are members of your network right now, there are some really interesting growth levers you have. So obviously there's getting them to use the platform more, mow their lawn more often. There's providing more services. So I assume that once they're connected to your service, you can enable this platform to provide, hey, do you want your windows cleaned? Or do you want your snow shoveled? they have some of that up here in Boston, or whatever it is. There's obviously a whole series of homeowner related services that I imagine you can put through the pipe. And then there's market expansion that we talked about earlier, the idea that you're going into Canada, you're going into the UK, there are probably secondary markets in the US. So there are all these levers for growth that you have. So how do you think about prioritizing which lever to pull?
A really good question, because you're right. There, like, part of the fun is you have all these different opportunities. And for us, we really looked at it like this. Like, it almost doesn't matter which one we pick. We just need to go all in on one. And so for a period of time, we just went all in on retention. It's okay, we're churning out half of the people that are using this. We got to really talk to these people, figure out what is causing that. And so we fixed that. We got that over 80%. And then we went to, okay, now we need to get more people to use this thing and on a market by market basis. So how do we do that? How do we get more traffic? And then we were like, okay, we're working in 6 markets. Now all we need to do is just go wider and expand geographically. And so that was the vector that we attacked. And so then after we did that, then we started to look at, okay, we're doing pretty good at we're in every major city. We retain a decent, respectable number of people that use it. We're always working on getting more traffic, but what else can we do now? And then we started attacking what they call expansion revenue, which is these users come in, they spend some money. How do you get them to spend more money? And you do it from a standpoint of adding more services and like educating them on, a lot of our users just get their grass cut every 14 days. And we went through this whole feature set of educating people to get it done every 7 days and actually makes them a happier customer. And the vendor happier too. And so really attacking like the expansion revenue piece of it is what we've been spending the last year and a half on, honestly. And so I think, like, when you're bootstrapped, you have to focus all of your intensity on one or two things at a time and almost not even worry about the other things. Ideally, you can come to the starting line experienced in all this stuff, and you can raise a bunch of capital and hire a really smart team and just go crush it. But that hasn't been the case for me. This was my first tech startup, and like, I had to learn all of this stuff the hard way by doing it the wrong way, and it's through trial and error. And we didn't raise any capital, and so we have funded it off of its own revenues. And so just really focusing on one thing at a time, like you said, one lever at a time, and just taking that as far as we could and then moving on to the next thing is one of our keys to success.
So Brian, I think we actually have a lot of investors who listen to our call, and I think they're salivating over your business now, realizing that you completely bootstrapped this thing, which is amazing, up to this kind of revenue run rate, which is really difficult to do. So maybe you'll get some inbounds from some big investors who want to throw big checks at you to make it grow faster.
That stuff's pretty good for the ego. So yeah.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I wanted to ask you though, you talked a little bit about retention, and I assume a piece of that is an interesting challenge you have in this kind of a very diverse marketplace is keeping and maintaining a set of brand standards. And so how do you do that to maintain a GreenPal level of service for all the service providers that are working for your end clients?
It's really challenging, because when you don't own the production and you are basically connecting buyers and sellers, how do you reliably predict and reliably deliver a consistent experience? And that was a really tough challenge for us for many years, because we didn't have the liquidity. We didn't have a whole lot of vendors using the platform. And so it was just one that we just kept our heads down and kept working on it, and slowly began to build in the controls to understand this is what a reliable service provider acts like and performs. And we have to find more of them and promote them and sideline and demote the service providers that just aren't reliable. It took us a long time to figure that out. And some of the cursory ways we do it is we look at the data. We understand that, okay, does Chuck's lawn care service get booked over 45% of the time for a second lawn mowing? And that to us is a good leading indicator. If they're not getting booked for a second lawn mowing, well then to us, that's a passive point it's a passive data point that homeowners are able to tell us without having to explicitly tell us that if Chuck was any good or not. And if he's not getting booked over and over again, he's not any good. We need to quit showing him new opportunities. And this person that's getting booked a second time for 80% of the time, we need to show them more opportunities. And so little things like that to promote the good performing service providers that are serious about this business, that want to grow their revenue, want to take care of their customers, and sideline the folks that just aren't serious about it. And not everybody's cut out to be in the lawn mowing business. It's our platform's job to surface the good ones and demote the ones that aren't reliable and enable the homeowner to sidestep all that nonsense. Because when they attempt to get this chore done in analog, they have to deal with that BS. They have to deal with the person who flakes. They got to deal with the person who doesn't do a good job, doesn't blow off the back patio. They got to deal with the person that ghosts them after the first mowing. It's our platform's job to sidestep those, to sideline those folks so consumers don't have to experience that.
And do you create a level of service provider, going back to the Uber model, like an Uber Black as an example? You're going to pay more, they're going to be a high premium service. Do you have any kind of stratification like that in your service providers?
We do. We try to. So it's not a completely commodity service. And that's one of the mistakes that a lot of Uber for X startups have made over the last decade, is they treated their suppliers as fungible commodities. And when in fact, that's not the case. It's not the case with a home cleaner, not the case with a masseuse, not the case with a laundry service, and it certainly isn't the case with a lawn mowing service. Even though all of those verticals I just named, like $500 million of capital has been crashed into the ground trying to Uberize them. You don't really care who picks you up to drive you to the airport, but you do care that the same lawn mowing service is going to be on your property week after week. And so that was something we knew from the beginning, and we were able to sidestep the mistake that a lot of other startups have made that ultimately caused them to not ever take off. And so when the homeowner onboards, they elect and outline, okay, I want it perfect, or I just want my lawn neat, or I don't care, just knock it down and keep the city off my butt. And that's, we have segmented it out into those three types of service expectations. And so then service providers bid it accordingly. They understand, okay, yeah, this person is going to be a little picky. They want a really nice job. I got a factor. I need to spend more time on it. Whereas this person is just a rental property and they just want it every 2 weeks and they just want it knocked down. And so that's how we kind of try to delineate the service expectation with what the service provider can deliver or is willing to deliver. And that's how we make a better match between the two. And then on the supplier side, we have over time, like taking a page out of Airbnb's playbook, it's okay, this is an elite service provider. They have an elite badge by their name, and they get that by showing up on time over 80% of the time, by getting booked for recurring services more than 75% of the time, by carrying a qualitative feedback score over 4.7, all of these like high level KPIs that allow us to understand at scale that this is an elite service provider. And so it's kind of like the super host thing with Airbnb. And so we try to figure out what we can do to use our data to better facilitate better matches between buyers and sellers. So it just works out better on both sides of the transaction. And it's taken us a long time to get there, but every year we're trying to make it better and better. Here we are 8 years in, and the vision is still the same as it was in 2013. We're still working on making it more reliable, more cost-effective, enabling service providers to make more money with less work. Like, we're still working on the same problem.
And what you bring to the table is interesting, Brian, because you mentioned some of these other Uber for X things. And part of the challenge, I think, is a lot of people come and say, I'm going to build up Uber for X, and they've never worked in X. And you did your dues in the business, spending that time doing that. And I think that makes a huge difference, because you understand, you may not have had depth in the software business, but you understand the core service that you're delivering much, much deeper than most people do. And that's probably the thing that is one of the things anyway that was really central in driving the success for GreenPal today.
Definitely helped. It helped understanding the industry from day one. It helped understanding like what the dynamics of the lawn mowing business were, and building a product that kind of adhered to those, to that gravity. And to your point, a lot of Uber for X companies failed. And what I was witnessing along the way was like, damn, man, venture capital is killing these businesses because it's requiring them to grow faster than they're designed to grow. And one thing I started to see was this recurring theme of nothing spelt doom for a startup faster than like great marketing on a bad product. Like that caused it, like hiring a growth team prematurely before you had a delightful customer experience accelerated the death spiral. And I saw that over and over again, because the trap that these entrepreneurs were falling in was like, okay, we have a product. It's pretty good. We just raised $5 million. We got to grow 10X in 18 months, just pour on the gas. And it just caused it to blow apart. It was like, I saw it over and over again. It was like attaching rocket boosters to the side of a wooden barn, and it is blowing apart. And you would think a lot of smart people crashed a lot of money into the ground for a 5-year period there. And we're just sitting there watching it, like humbly just building this thing profitable the whole way through. And yeah, sure, it sucked. We couldn't go as fast as we wanted to, but I think that's why we are here today, is it's because we didn't raise capital. We funded the business on its own revenues.
It makes a ton of sense, Brian. And you see a lot of people making those mistakes, and especially the one that you brought up around trying to accelerate before you've got some real stability in the product. And it's just too ready, and you burn out the market really quickly. If you get your name out there and the reputation is negative, so you've built that up patiently over a period of time. And that is really an amazing way to build a business. And obviously where you are now is pretty incredible. With, again, GreenPal now has 200,000 homeowners on the platform, 20 million in revenue in 8 years. And 8 years is not a long time to build up to 20 million in revenue, by the way, not at all, especially with the kind of revenue that you're getting. I assume has some really great profitability in the business, because it is the marketplace. You're not doing the service delivery yourself. So it is a really nice model that you have here, which is super exciting.
It's taken a long time to get here. We look back like, wow, look how far we've came, but it's still day one. We have so much further to go in terms of, this is a $99 billion industry. A lot of people don't know that it's that big. It's a $99 billion industry, and the top 20 players in the space only constitute 1% of that. And so it's very fragmented. It's very mom and pop. And our focus is to empower those service providers to operate like the big guys. And we have so much further to go on achieving that vision.
That's amazing. And it was funny. I was going to ask you a question, but I think you've answered it for me already. And in what your last statement here that says you have a long way to go, I was going to ask you, your first act was building an amazing service business that you ended up selling and had a really successful outcome. Your second act, you built a software company and a marketplace. What's the third act?
You know, it's funny. When I sold my first business, I retired, or at least I thought I was going to, and I got bored and I realized, wow, there's something missing. There's purpose. Like my business was giving me purpose in life, and now that's gone. And so it felt empty. And so I started the second company to fill that void. And so, yeah, to your point, I don't know what I would do. For the last couple of years, it's been fun running this business. Just now gotten fun. The first 5 or 6 years were really tough. It was an exercise of faith for my co-founders and I. We just worked our butts off and just persevered. And now it's actually fun, because we have a really good team around us and people who are just doing really good work on what they're good at. And I'm no longer having to write code, and which I'm a terrible front-end engineer. But for many years, I was having to like cobble together interfaces and web views and things like that. I'm not oriented for, but it was what we had to do to get through that level of the game. And so, yeah, to your point, I don't know. I don't know what I do. I don't know what Act 3 looks like. I just want to keep growing this thing as big as I can and keep trying to help as many small business owners as I can that are in this industry while offering up a nice convenience for homeowners.
It sounds like there's a lot more to do in this business. And with 20 million out of 99 billion, that leaves basically 99 billion left. So there is a lot there. So I think we're coming to the end of our time, but one question we like to ask all of our guests is, because our audience is as CMOs and people who'd like to be a CMO someday. So what advice would you give those people, especially with your perspective? You've had some amazing perspectives on how to think and be a marketer, even though you're not, as you said, classically one. What would you tell someone who's an aspiring CMO?
Oh, aspiring CMO is in so many things. Read all the books that I mentioned. Everything that Claude Hopkins ever wrote and everything that Steve Blank ever wrote is really good stuff. Of course, you got to be an expert copywriter. That can make a good marketer. I think a tactical thing that I think every CMO needs to hear, existing or aspiring, is do business with yourself. Is sign up for the product once a week. And it doesn't matter if you're like a small business marketer for a hair salon, go to that hair salon and get your hair cut. Or if you're doing like major campaigns for a franchise, like a Subway, eat at Subway once a week. Like for me, I run an app that connects homeowners with lawn care services. I sign up for our app once a week, and I always find something that needs improvement. So even as a CMO, do business with yourself. It'll be one of the highest leverage uses of your time that you can make.
That's amazing advice, Brian. And what I'll do is I'll get from Brian some of the links to the resources. He mentioned some great books. I'll put them in the show notes so people can check them out later. And I wanted to thank you, Brian, for your time and your incredible advice and experience. It's a really amazing story. Really encourage everyone. The good news is almost everyone who's listening here can be a GreenPal customer. So definitely check it out. I assume we'll put a link in the show notes, but in case they're just listening, where do they go, Brian, to learn more about GreenPal?
Yeah, if anybody listening to this doesn't want to mow their own yard and smell like gas and cut grass, you can just download GreenPal in the App Store or Play Store. Anybody wants to reach me, hit me up on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Brian, thanks so much. Really enjoyed the discussion. And if you and the audience have other topics you'd like to cover, recommendations, give us a shout out. Send them to thenextcmo@planna.com. Make sure you follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter and all those places. Check out our website. And thanks again for listening. And thanks, Brian, for being on the Next CMO podcast.